Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, joined today by Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I'm well, sort of in the first phases of a heat wave, but for the race, coping.
Very good, very good. And also Anlu Kiever. Anlu, how are you doing?
Oh, doing good, thank you, Nicholas. We have a little bit of sunshine today after a somewhat winter-ish looking week. Not cold, but you are doing well today, thanks.
Fantastic. Well, let's get into the first news story of today, which is decidedly not fantastic. This is a survey of South African households looking into the problem of hunger and poverty. A National Food and Nutrition Security Survey has found that 63.5% of households are what they call food insecure. Now, this doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, people are starving or that people don't ever have food or something like that. But basically what it means is that that 63% of South African households are kind of on the edge of being able to afford proper nutrition. This is almost two-thirds of households in the country, meaning that only 36.5% of households were what they called food secure. Of the 63%, around 17.5% were severely food insecure, 15% had what they call moderate hunger, and about 5% suffered severe hunger. So that means basically that you're kind of on the verge of sort of starving. The survey also looked at some other things, interesting stuff, showing that at the same time, we've also got a problem of obesity. And this is because a lot of people are eating a lot of sort of calorie-dense but not nutritious-dense food. The rate of obesity in KwaZulu-Natal has reached levels of 39%, which is above the country's average of about 32%. This, of course, puts strain on the public health system because if you're very poor and you have like sort of heart problems or something to do with being overweight, you're costing the country, unfortunately, money, and also it reduces life expectancy. The provinces which are some of the worst for wasting and stunting, that is when children aren't receiving enough nutrition as they're growing up and as a result are not growing properly, suffering sometimes learning disabilities or at the very least physical disabilities, you know, being extra short or being weak or not having strong bones. The provinces where that seems to be the worst is the Northern and Western Cape. So, Herman, let me start with you. This came out, John Steenhuisen, the agricultural minister, said that this was a primary concern that needed to be addressed. I know the DA has made a big deal about increasing childhood nutrition in particular over the past couple of years. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think this is yet another symptom of the joblessness crisis in South Africa. What do you make of this?
I think you're quite right. One can look at a few sort of causes for this type of malnutrition crisis. Poverty, going along with that is unemployment. Then you've got the rising living costs. But then you've also got a problem of what they call food deserts, where there's a lack of access to markets that offer the variety of healthy foods needed to sustain families and societies and communities. But then there's also the problem of our declining numbers of commercial farmers in South Africa. So this issue has quite a few levels to it, and every level could be quite rationally and fairly considered a government failure. One can look at, you know, two countries that we quite often cite as counterexamples for where to go, and that is Zimbabwe and Venezuela. Both countries who have very fertile soil, really able to produce food, but due to policy changes and state intervention, the destruction of property rights, the overall depression of the economy, the ability and incentive to make use of those natural resources just declined. Now, South Africa has fertile ground, especially along the eastern side of our country, stretching somewhat into the Free State. But for the most, South Africa, despite our agrarian history, isn't necessarily well suited to agriculture that produces food at a mass scale. So this is a problem that Minister Steenhuisen must face up to, but it's a bigger problem as well. If we are going to be in a situation where it's difficult to get a job, it's going to be difficult to buy food. It's really just as simple as that. If it's going to be difficult to open a store, to get secure the capital, to open a shop or a restaurant or whatever you want to engage in sort of the food part of the economy, it's going to be tough. So this really has very human costs, but very economic causes. And Andu recently spearheaded a paper on infrastructure failure in South Africa, which is another component of this type of food insecurity, because infrastructure at the best connects markets and consumers and families and the economies of various points in the country. And if you can't get money from one place to another, if you can't get people from one place to another, if you can't get goods and services, then you can't get food from one place to another. So it really is just a negative spiral with a failing economy and failing economic policies at the heart of it. Economic policy at its best is empowering people to there where they are, make the best of what they have and earn a living from that. If you don't have that basic idea of people earning an income by having a value-add contribution to society, then you get problems like this down the line. Of course, then you've got the more sort of medium-term problem, which is the property rights issue. We've gone through about a decade of increasing villainization of the agricultural community in South Africa, and it seems to have, over the last few years, largely due to work like that done by our colleague Terence Corrigan, that villainization of farmers and farm workers has stopped. But we do need to recognize that this isn't just a bleeding we should stop in terms of we should stop losing commercial farmers. If South Africa wants to make sure that we have food security, we need to incentivize commercial farming. And that means securing property rights. It means making it as simple as possible for people to enter the sector and serve the market and earn an income from that. So the consequences are intensely personal, painful, visceral, harrowing, but the causes are the mundanities and the boring stats and figures of economic failure.
No, that's exactly right. You know, the reality about the modern world is that modern farming is actually extremely efficient, and that even in relatively, as you say, agriculturally not great countries like South Africa, where we have a lot of sort of dry lands or pasture lands, which are not amazing for farming, you can produce an enormous amount of food. But you have to have all of the right conditions. You have to have the good market conditions. You have to have the good infrastructure. You have to have all those things you mentioned in order for that system to work to bring food prices down. And when you have lots of unemployment and lots of poverty, and then you also have all of those impediments from bad policy to bad infrastructure hurting our farming communities and also hurting imports. Of course, we know, for example, that our ports are not working correctly. You really do sit with a situation where food is much more difficult to come by than it should be. And one of the things I've noticed over the last couple of inflation cycles, whenever inflation has come into the news, is that food inflation has often actually tended to buck a little bit of the trend of other bits of inflation seem to be calming down a bit, but food inflation in many of the most recent reports I've read still seems to be increasing somewhat. And the consequences, as we can see from this report, are pretty severe. A lot of people's lives, particularly children's lives, are severely affected by not having enough food. And it is a major detriment to the quality of life of many people when they're constantly having to think about, can I afford enough food for the rest of the month? Andu, your thoughts on this issue, what government should be doing maybe to turn the situation around?
Nicholas, perhaps just on the point of food inflation going up, there's the Housing Affordability Index. So they measure it's a basket of 44 like commonly bought food items. So the latest report indicated that for 2023, last year, between last year and the year before 2022, between the 44 items in the food basket, it increased by 350 Rand, which is quite a lot for a poor household. I think if you consider that these people, they're dependent on every single Rand that they earn, it definitely has a very big influence. On the point of what government should actually be doing about this, I'm going to take a little bit of a long turn here, so I'll try and keep it short. But there's a march today. Was it? It's in Johannesburg, I think, about the ANC Youth League wanting more young people to be included in the economy and have jobs. And the moment I read it, I got so upset and frustrated, actually. I felt numb, to be completely honest with you. And the reason is we continuously keep pointing to the wrong thing. It doesn't help you organize an entire protest, but you don't actually protest against what causes the outcome. And in this instance, they keep protesting against unemployment, but instead of actually protesting what causes the unemployment. And by protesting what causes the unemployment, it's also then much more possible for them to actually protest what outcomes they'd like to see. And in this sense, for example, I'd like to mention that something as simple, it's a quick win, the Job Seekers Exemption Certificate. It can help a lot more young people who's part of households, many of these people being the breadwinners of many of these households, to actually get a job, get experience, and then enter into the labor market in a much better position. And in that sense, then also help their family and their whole community to be in a much better position to actually manage the cost of living that they're facing at the moment. And then there's a very important thing that I think we should also, it's definitely garnering a little bit more attention now in lead up to the MTBBS at the end of the month, but it's the case for the zero VAT food basket. And I think a very important element that we should actually consider here is chicken. I understand that there's a strong argument for not actually expanding the food basket, but I think what's more important here is to actually mention that what we see in the report and what you mentioned earlier is that many of the causes behind obesity is the fact that they don't actually get nutrient-based food. And it's in that sense very important to actually add something like chicken. It's a staple food for many poor households. And I think unlike many luxury items or some niche food items, chicken is consumed across all income levels. And it plays a particularly important role in low-income households. So in that sense, I think the relative savings it would help, it would actually enable them, poorer households to have, would definitely not only contribute to them being able to battle or manage their cost of living crisis, but also to then be in a much better and a much healthier position.
Nick, if I may quickly just come in here, and to add to that issue, I think we also need to look at two sort of fundamental ideological issues, because I think it's very important to, as Anlu suggests, look at the minutiae, the short-term wins that could be achieved. And added to that, I would sort of add a medium and a long-term category of improvements that could really, in the short, medium, and long-term, see this problem being solved. The short-term issues are, what can we do now to ease food prices and make nutritious food as affordable as possible? And that's what Andrew is describing there. Then on the medium side of things, medium-term side of things, earlier this year, the Institute published a Blueprint for Growth paper / Waste Cut Taxes, which made a very solid argument that VAT could actually be reduced to 11.5% without impacting any government funding, if it works in parallel with a restructuring of procurement processes that ensures value for money delivery rather than things like BEE and race-based procurement tender criteria. So the medium term would be to readjust the VAT load on citizens to free up money that they're currently spending on other things that they could be rechanneling towards buying nutritious food. And then in the long term, there's the two ideological things that I think we need to challenge head on. Number one is this romanticized, almost Leo Tolstoy, Afro-Marxist dream of a subsistence farming community. in a country like South Africa, that doesn't work, purely for the reason that we don't have enough fertile soil to go along with that. And as you pointed out in your earlier, Nick, the point of modern farming is to chase efficiency. If you want maximum nutritious output, then you need to achieve minimum input in terms of resources. Subsistence farming is the opposite of that. It is very basic. It is very primitive. It is not developing and inefficient.
Exactly. And there is no country on earth which has a majority of its population as subsistence farmers that is not also completely and utterly crippled by poverty sort of over generations and generations. This is from the dawn of agriculture 10,000 years ago until the modern day. Subsistence farming has been the primary method by which the absolute most poor, desperate people in society have actually fed and looked after themselves. And the idea that, you know, the great problem in South Africa is that we don't have enough people with land to do subsistence farming is so insane. It is like literally the opposite of what we should be trying to do. People should be living in cities, developing their skills, entering into modern service industries and manufacturing jobs, not trying to, as you say, embrace some sort of romantic ideal of 19th century ideologues and you know, muck about growing 5 millis on a piece of land while they starve. It's just complete insanity.
And going along with that, the other ideological sort of lie that exists alongside this wrong-headed romanticism is just the tragedy of the commons. We see it happen so much that if we say, no, but subsistence farming can work, if we have this idea that we have collective resources, like, you know, collective grazing grounds, wherever that has been tried, you have gotten people take out more than they put in. When you have property rights, that not only gives you the right to own that property, but it also gives you a limit of resources that you need to shepherd very responsibly and sustainably. So we are up against these short, medium, and long-term issues that if we can solve short, medium, and long-term issues, there's no reason why this type of malnutrition data and crisis cannot be turned around in a generation.
Exactly. This is one of, I think, the great indictments of the post-apartheid South Africa, that we've not been able to solve something as basic as getting people secure in how much food they have to eat. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is little one that kind of makes me think that EFF leader Julius Malema is not really keeping a good eye on his strategic position right now. So we've seen recently in the very credible Social Research Foundation polling that the EFF support appears to have dropped since the election. They were polling in the last SRF poll at around about 6%. And also that the EFF's importance in keeping the ANC in power in the metros in Gauteng has been decreasing. The ANC threw out the MMC of finance from the EFF in Ekurhuleni relatively recently. I think it was a couple months ago. Action SA has joined the coalition government in Joburg, meaning that the ANC no longer really needs the EFF support there. So the EFF, if they pulled out, would not be able to collapse that government. And in Tswane, the EFF is very much a junior partner, I think, in that coalition agreement between Action SA, the ANC, and some other parties. And yet, Julius Malema has been telling the media that he is for mayor sharing. He says that the ANC agreed to support an EFF mayor in the city of Ekurhuleni, but has since reneged. He went on to say, quote, "We are for mayor sharing. We are for Tswane Action SA, Joburg ANC, Ekurhuleni EFF. But the ANC, its form and character, is very disloyal to its decisions because we've agreed to this and it only changed later against what we agreed upon." Now, Anlu, let me start with you. The EFF is not in a good way. The departure of Floyd Shivambu was not a great look for the party. They have much more political competition now in the sort of radical racialist space from MK, who have a very similar offering, but, you know, with sort of more organization, it seems. The EFF really does, I think, seem to be in a bit of crisis at the moment. And yet Malema's move is to what? Call for them to be given more power in Ekurhuleni, even as they have less negotiating leverage than ever before? What do you make of this?
Well, I think definitely you can see that they're being sidelined. And I think, so what did he phrase it? He phrased it as the nature of coalition politics, and said that it just needs to be battled out. And I think him actually framing it as something that just needs to be battled out, rather than actually in the sense that we know Malema as somebody he doesn't take it sitting down. And him in this way, actually, instead of calling for the accountability in that sense, or the ANC keeping their word, he gives it away. He gives away that he doesn't actually have that much political leverage that he perhaps once had. And I think there was another very interesting thing that he said, which was that the ANC obviously removing the EFF and members from important positions. It was because they were threatened by young, capable leaders. And it just comes across as him deflecting off what their declining influence. I am honestly just very tired of the whole Gauteng, the entire Gauteng and all their politics. it's just very tiresome.
Well, we'll try not to take it personally. My word.
I'm on the verge of defecting to the Western Cape. I must admit, to the viewers now at this point. But anyway, look, not that I weep too many tears for the EFF, because I think they've been a very malevolent force in our politics. But if I was to just put on my sort of political strategist hat here, it really seems like the EFF should be in a kind of consolidation mood at the moment, that they should be saying, okay, we need to withdraw, we need to focus on what we're good at, we need to re-energize the party, we need to get some good news cycles going, and maybe we shouldn't be trying to control metros, which we have very little hope of actually having any sort of real influence over. I don't think the ANC is going to give up, particularly because the ANC in Ekurhuleni seems to absolutely despise the EFF. That's the one place in Gauteng where they just have no time for the EFF whatsoever, and the infighting has been the most intense. Herman, what do you think is? Am I just missing something? Is Malema got a strategy or plan here that I'm just too stupid to see?
Well, if you're too stupid to see it, then I'm too stupid as well, because it's sort of, I've said to a handful of politicians with whom I work and spoken, is that one of the problems with politics in South Africa is that politicians don't watch enough rugby. And part of that is that when a team is under pressure in an 80-minute game, and they had a really bad first half, what usually happens between the first half and the second half is the coach sort of gets his team to revert back to what has always worked for them. Go back to what your strength is. And it seems, to poor Malema's detriment, the EFF's cupboard is bare when it's a question of go back to your strengths. Because if we look at what the EFF's strengths have been over the last decade of its existence, it has been the politics of spectacle. Whenever it has been able to command public attention, it has been successful. It has been successful in payback the money. Perhaps the most definitive moment of its parliamentary presence was in 2015 and 16 and so on, when they hijacked the spectacle of the State of the Nation address to embarrass President Zuma and make the ANC look weaker and make themselves look stronger, whilst in a way sidelining the DEA as an influential party. But now they've got a bit of a problem. Ever since 2020, they've really had a problem. 2020 interrupted the typical politics of spectacle. You could have no mass gatherings. You couldn't have parliament. If you wanted to interrupt a COVID-era parliamentary session, the speaker would just mute you. So they couldn't utilize the politics of spectacle anymore. Then COVID went on and we sort of prepared for the next political challenge, and that was this year's elections. And actually, a year ago, things were looking good for the EFF. If you think towards the end of July 2023, they had their 10-year celebrations where they filled the FNB Stadium in Soweto, 90,000 seat capacity they filled. And then they put Malema on sort of a platform and sang You Raise Me Up or something. But then in December, the EFF had its goose finally cooked, because on 16 December, Jacob Zuma endorses MK. And if you look at the numbers, they never get back to their height of July, August, to such an extent that by the time it was the campaign launch and the manifesto launch of the EFF in 2024, they couldn't fill the Peter Mokaba Stadium in Mbombela, which is half the capacity of the FNB Stadium in Soweto. So what happened for them is they lost the ability of the politics of spectacle and the momentum that could have given them into the 2021 election cycle. And then they lost the insurgency label, which then went to MK. And as I've said before, Zuma was such an inspiration to Malema's political identity that when Zuma sort of returned, voters had the opportunity of either supporting a tribute act or just going to the concerts because Elvis was on tour again. If you had to choose between Malema's imitation of Zuma's populism and Zuma's populism itself, why on earth would you choose the second-hand version? So in a way, the question for the EFF now is, and if Malema had any strategic or political appreciation for the sensitivity and the vulnerability of this moment, it would be, what is the EFF uniquely good at that they can now reestablish as a basis for building that relevance, building that confidence? And to my mind, it will probably be get back to the politics of spectacle, get back to interrupting parliament, because I can't see MK doing it. But it's a really weak hand to play. But to my mind, it's the only hand to play that they really have left. They've had a bad few years. And I mean, it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
Yeah, no, and as I've made the point many times before, is that Malema, with his, what, you know, cult of personality, has strangled the potential for any other leaders or kind of talent to grow up in the party without being sort of stifled under his enormous ego. So, you know, I'm not surprised that Floyd Chivambu jumped ship the moment there was a viable alternative for him to go to. And I wouldn't be surprised if more EFF people do that in the future. I very much could see the so-called progressive caucus actually kind of consolidating into the structure of MK, which might actually be the thing that keeps MK going if Zuma was to disappear from our politics. Anyway, something interesting to think about. Anlu, briefly, any final thoughts you have?
Yes, perhaps I can just add that I actually really hope that no EFF member listens to the TDF show. They really do not need any additional advice. They can just bye-bye.
Oh, we do sometimes get people who vehemently disagreeing with us listening to us, and I think that's often quite fun. Anyway, let us go on to our final story. Look, we were going to talk and think about one other South African story, but Herman has been bursting at the seams to talk about what's going on in UK politics, which is kind of his passion. So, Herman, the Conservative Party in the UK has, after a bad, very bad election for them, is in the middle of holding a leadership conference. And we are into the final stages of that leadership contest. Who is going to be the next leader of the Conservative Party in the UK?
So the fascinating thing is, just to put into context how badly the Conservative Party did in the July elections, is that there's approximately 122 positions in a typical UK government, from the Prime Minister to Cabinet, to cabinet secretaries, to junior ministers, and so on. So you need about 122 members of parliament to be able to create a government. There are that many sort of, it's called the payroll vote in the House of Commons. The problem for the Tories is that in opposition, that means you need 122 shadows. You need, for the Prime Minister, you need it's the shadow opposite, which is the leader of the opposition. And for cabinet positions, the shadows and so on all the way down. So if you're going to shadow a government of 122 members, then it doesn't help that you have 121 MPs in total. Somewhere there's going to be some job sharing. And that is just to illustrate the extent to which the 2024 election was bad for the Conservatives. It was almost so bad that they didn't have enough MPs to actually function as an opposition. And that's the first point. And that's a very depressing state of affairs. As someone who would be likely a Conservative voter along the Gladstonian liberal lines of Thatcher and so on, one should be in a state of depression. And yet the party isn't, because the last 3 months has seen the start of a new Labour government under Sir Keir Starmer. And if you were to ask ChatGPT or DALL-E or Midjourney to design for you the most boring person ever to wear a suit, it's very likely that you would get an image of Keir Starmer. The man is as charismatic as an amputated foot, and he has so far shown the political abilities of an amputated foot. Within the first 100 days, he has told pensioners that he's going to essentially scrap winter fuel allowances for pensioners. And in a cold country like the UK, it really matters whether you can heat your home or not, but that's going to be scrapped. Of course, the people loved him for that. But then worse, he has also had to fire his chief of staff. Now, if that sounds weirdly similar to a South African situation of perhaps a party leader having to fire their chief of staff, it's not a good start. Having gotten rid of Sue Gray, Keir Starmer has now sort of had to do a type of government reboot that you usually do about 2 or 3 years in, within 2 or 3 months. But beyond that, the reason for optimism in the Conservative Party is that there's a contest. The leadership contest has now identified the final two. It's Robert Jenrick versus Kemi Badenoch. And all the money, including my own, were I a betting man, would be on Kemi Badenoch to win. She has been my political crush since her maiden speech in the Commons in 2017, a proper classical liberal, someone who grew up under the military socialist governments of Nigeria, someone who then went to the UK, became a staunch classical liberal, representing the idea of a minimalist state, a free market. I mean, she's in the last year said capitalism isn't a dirty word. When last did we hear a politician in the UK able to say that? And she's the odds-on favourite. The membership of the Conservative Party, who now gets to decide which of the two candidates become leader of the party and leader of the opposition, have for the last three leadership election cycles preferred Kemi Badenoch. She's charismatic. I think she's intelligent. I think she's combative in the right way that opposition leader must be. So for all the drab, for all the risk of essentially being wiped out as a serious political party, I think the Tories are on the way up. I think classical liberalism is on the way up. And if I'm invited again onto a Daily Friend show to geek out about another bit of foreign politics, I would talk about Pierre Poilievre in Canada. Pierre Poilievre in Canada and Kemi Badenoch are two promising politicians of a classical liberal center-right flavor who see capitalism as a good thing and who I think will probably be two of the most prominent young up-and-coming leaders of the next 10 years, likely to become prime ministers of their respective countries. So keep an eye out on the 2nd of November. The Tories will hopefully announce Kemi Badenoch as their leader, and things can only get better from there.
Interesting thoughts. And we shall obviously keep an eye on that. I'm sure it will come up at some point. I can't remember exactly when the Canadian elections are, but I think they're relatively soon. And then we're going to...
within the next year.
Within the next year, there we go. Anyway, with that, I'm afraid we are quite a bit over time, so I'm going to have to call it there. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Hope you found the show interesting. We will be back next week. Hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone.